I'm Simon Adam, host of Crazy Making. Today's episode marks the second episode of a series on child and youth mental health. I speak with Sherry Taylor about youth mental health, particularly how identity develops in young people in the context of mental health and illness. She takes us on a journey of what it might be like for the developing young person as they grapple with making sense of what it means to have disruptions in their mental health. Sherry is a school teacher and a doctoral student at the University of Toronto, engaging in research on identity theory and identity development in the context of youth mental health. Hi, Sherry. Thank you for appearing on Crazy Making. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I'd like to start off with just understanding what you're up to these days. So can you just tell us a little bit about your doctoral research?
Sure. I guess I should probably start by defining myself and my career, et cetera. So I have been a teacher in the Toronto District School Board since I think 2005, maybe 2004, but for sure 2005. And I have always operated as a special education teacher or a student success teacher, and more recently in my career as a guidance person. So I've been in contact with young people who are in some degree of distress or educational difficulty my entire career. And I noticed when I first started in education, and I came to education through a psychology degree, very much versed in psychiatric lingo. And I noticed when I came to education at first that there was a very different language going on, and it was the language of pedagogy and the language of psychoeducational assessments, and a completely different world than I was used to in psychology. But cutting forward about a decade into my career in 2014, I noticed very suddenly that the language of psychiatry was entering education in a very pronounced way. And at the time, I thought that was a good thing because I was very much aware that a lot of my students in special education especially were in a fair amount of distress. But I came through a process that I won't go too much into detail now, but basically became aware of a drug company's involvement in an Ontario rollout of a mental health education initiative. I became very suddenly jolted into a very critical stance on what exactly was the intention of having mental health and psychiatry language enter education. So it kind of came with sort of a structural view of why would this drug company be involved in this in any way? And I did a lot of my very early research before I started my PhD on how that came to happen, which I won't go into right now. But what I'm sort of interested in my research is how young people become identified with a psychiatric diagnosis and the process by which young people become psychiatrized and the role of schools in that process. So my work involves interviewing teachers who are involved in teaching mental health education and in interviewing young people who have been psychiatrized. And I use that word, which might not be familiar to some of your listeners. And that's kind of the way a person becomes identified with a psychiatric label. That's what psychiatrized means to me. So right now in my research, which you asked about, I am in the process of interviewing young people. And by young people, I mean people the age between 18 and 22. And those people would have been exposed to the education that I'm interested in. And just interviewing them about their experience of being in school and having exposure to mental health education and their understandings of themselves as related to the psychiatric diagnoses that they identify with.
Great, thanks, Sherry. Now, you said you're doing interviews right now. Is that right?
I am.
Okay, and based on what you've done so far, are you able to talk about some preliminary findings? Are you?
So, I guess what I'm seeing so far is people who are very firmly identified with their labels. So they have taken the label that they have been assigned either by themselves or by a doctor, and they take those labels very seriously. I'm also finding that the young people that I'm talking to, whether they actually describe it explicitly or not, have an understanding of themselves as having not just a label, but some kind of biological or otherwise entrenched flaw in their being that makes them have or be their psychiatric diagnosis. So for example, I talked to one woman who was originally diagnosed as having a personality disorder. And she advocated for herself to become diagnosed with a different disorder, that being bipolar disorder, and found evidence for this in the fact that her grandmother had been diagnosed with manic depression at around the same age that she had begun feeling the way she felt. And she really felt that this was sort of a hereditary and biological trait that she had, that there was no way that she could escape from.
Interesting.
Yeah. Similarly, I had a student come to me once, a very bright young man in my guidance office, and he came in and kind of blurted out, I have hereditary biological major depression. And he, at 14, was convinced that he had some kind of inherent flaw in his biological being that led to him having this label. So the other sort of thread or trend that I'm seeing in my data, and because I'm kind of have an anti-capitalist stance on in my work, is I'm seeing that a lot of the people that I'm interviewing have significant socioeconomic disparities or disadvantages or significant social issues going on in their lives or families. And while they are able to identify these issues very clearly in some cases, like one person that I interviewed was very aware of living going to an affluent school, but being from the other side of the tracks, and really aware, very acutely aware of these differences that she had from her fellow students. But at the same time, there was nothing in the way she identified herself as those aspects of her existence as being related to her identification as having depression. So I'm sort of finding this kind of bifurcation of awareness, where there's an awareness in a person of their social or economic issues, but at the same time, they're identifying and really understanding themselves as biologically somehow different.
Interesting, this concept of bifurcation of awareness. And the, you know, it sounds like the hereditary discourse is a pretty prominent discourse that you're finding, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned labels. And just for clarification purposes, labels, like what would be some examples of labels, Sherry?
Psychiatric labels?
Yes.
Yeah. So the people that I'm coming into contact with so far have had labels that are based on the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders, the DSM. And those are such things as obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, social anxiety, things of that nature. So they describe themselves as having these things, like they would have a cold or have some kind of medical condition. Yet I think of these labels as being very socially constructed. And especially if you look back at the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the past, you can really see the social construction, because the DSM of 1952 was a highly misogynist and very different document than the DSM of today, which is very symptom driven. And, you know, if you have 4 out of 9 of these symptoms, you are diagnosed as having the disorder, versus if you have 3, you don't.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Right. It's become more and more medicalized, right?
More and more medicalized since the DSM-4.
I still find it very misogynistic and racist and homophobic. There is so much
of
that.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, in 1973, in that version of the DSM, I think that might have been DSM-3, I'm not sure. Homosexuality was an actual disorder. You could be hospitalized. Your family could put you away.
Yeah.
You could spend your life in a psychiatric institution for being gay.
Yeah, yeah.
Which points at the social construction aspect of the DSM, right? Because we would think of that as audacious now, or a lot of people would, not everyone, but a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of reasonable people anyway, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, the social construction is very highly evident in the evolution of the various versions of the DSM, with all these quote unquote diagnoses or disorders or medical disorders that have come in and come out of the text. I always use the example to show how preposterous sometimes some of these diagnoses are, the example of drapetomania. And I don't know if you've heard of drapetomania.
I have.
Right, right. And so I use that even in my teaching. I talk about it, and oftentimes it just drops jaws. And for those listeners who don't know what drapetomania is, it's a disorder given to Black people who have attempted to flee their white owners, and therefore they are
slavery. Yeah.
Yeah. To flee slavery. So every time they try to flee, they are caught and seen by a psychiatrist and diagnosed as being mentally ill, because why would they want to flee slavery? You know, of course, that's left the DSM, the very, very early DSM versions a long time ago. It's been debunked as unscientific, but many other disorders have been also debunked, and there's a whole bunch that probably should be anyway.
Yeah.
Interesting. Sherry, I just want to go back to, you mentioned something about, you know, your research being also critical of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of your research and psychiatry and critical psychiatry, why is it also important to critique capitalism?
Well, because context matters. And, you know, to use the words anti-capitalist sort of evokes this kind of like ultra-Marxist sort of person. But the way I kind of look at capitalism is that it has tentacles that invade our everyday lives at all times, and we don't even really know that that's happening. And so when I say an anti-capitalist stance, I mean a stance that acknowledges that the way that we run our society affects people. And so when you have a label that describes a person, but doesn't take into account the context in which they live, including all the capitalist aspects of that, the dispossessing aspects of capitalist relations, I think that's very problematic. And I think that if I were to identify kind of one of the biggest trends or issues that have to do with young people identifying with a diagnosis, is that they have a focus on themselves rather than a focus on the world that they live in. And so while that's happening, they are actually displacing attention from the contexts that are dispossessive of them and that are affecting them in negative ways, and perhaps being kind of undercut by that. So while I wouldn't want to say, and I really haven't experienced this, that the young people that I've talked to are not aware of issues in the world, they so are. They're so aware of issues in the world. They're so aware of their environments. But at the same time, they have this, like I described before, this bifurcation where they are thinking of themselves as inherently flawed somehow. And so they're kind of focusing on, how do I fix this? How do I make this better? And while I think it's not a bad thing to focus on yourself and how to make your life better, I also think that there's a broader picture that has to be attended to, both on an individual level and societal level, whereby we can kind of collectively say, these are the writ large problems, and let's work together to envision something completely different than this, so that maybe we don't have to have the malaise, the anxiety, the depression that we have about our existences right now. So I have to say at this point, there was I attended a children's mental health conference kind of subversively. I was able to go through my work, but I had a critical eye the whole time that I was there. And they had this really interesting statistic. There was an Ontario children's health study done in 1983. And I was in high school at that time and I actually remember taking part in it. And it was, you know, multiple choice or whatever, pencil and paper. And they didn't do another one until 2014 when they did this school mental health study in Ontario. And they did, at this conference that I went to, they presented the differences. And the major stark difference between these two studies is that in 1983, there was a preponderance or a fairly high level of what they call conduct disorder. And conduct disorder is defined as kind of rebellious and lashing out behavior, you know, vandalism, petty crimes, that sort of thing directed outward at the world. And in 2014, conduct disorder had decreased significantly, whereas anxiety, depression in young people had increased extensively. So there's kind of this cross change in these two kinds of quote unquote disorders. And I found that fascinating because one is kind of an outward focused, I hate the world, let's do something. I mean, obviously conduct disorder, whatever you would like to call it right now, rebelliousness is not a focused kind of rebellion, but neither is it an inwardly focused kind of picture. And I kind of wondered to myself at the time, still do, if conduct disorder could be focused on actual problems that exist in the world. And maybe those young people, as they grew older, would have been more focused on those things rather than turn more inwardly on themselves. Mm. What kind of world could we have right now?
Very, very good question. Good point. I always find it fascinating to see the relationship between capitalism and capitalistic modes of production and the development of American psychiatry. Like, you know, it's very much co-entrenched. And I know, I remember speaking to abolitionist people who work towards the abolition of the psychiatric regime, who say you can't just get rid of the psychiatric institution. It's a multi-institutional complex that sort of goes hand in hand when you're looking at uprooting it and redeveloping it anew.
What did you say? Multi-institutional complex? That's lovely.
Yes. Are you gonna use that word now? All yours. And, but it really is. I mean, it's multiple, you know, there are multiple institutions and they interact and they support each other, you know, in various political, ideological, social, economic ways.
For sure.
Sherry, you mentioned something about sort of the entree into your research or your interests in this area having to do with pharmaceuticals or pharmaceutical discourse sort of entering, factoring into teaching and learning or your teaching work to the degree you can talk about it. Can you just help us understand what that was and what brought you into that?
Sure. So there's a lot of detail, but the broad strokes are that, when there are partners of partners of partners in the rolling out of any kind of initiative, there can be an entry point for capitalist enterprises to be able to assist and thereby get their own agendas inserted into whatever they want, wherever there's an entry point. And so in this particular case, there was a big, massive rollout of children's mental health initiatives in education by the Ministry of Education. And they had partnered with an organization who had partnered with a drug company. And the drug company developed this kind of very slick website where young people could access it and watch videos, et cetera. And the website was all in this particular drug company's colors. It was very kind of subversive and weird looking to me when I figured it out. It's not evil in a writ large kind of way. It's just opportunistic in business. And I think in a lot of ways, well-intentioned by people who exist within industry and education. But it has effect. And, you know, when I was working in a particular school and when this initiative was being rolled out, and I had chosen a couple of young people to be my ambassadors in this project. And the project was kind of a train-the-trainer model, whereby a couple of students would be sent away to a couple of day education rollout where they were with other students from the province and they were all being exposed to the same education. And the idea was that they would come back to their own schools and teach their fellow students what they'd learned. And they had been exposed to a short training by a registered nurse, a public health nurse who'd been assigned to our school. And that teacher had been, sorry, that nurse had been given very specific, I remember her holding her notebook and being given very specific instructions as to how she should educate these students as to how to get through a website and to show their fellow students what they could access on this particular website. So it was very interesting because the drug company, you know, was just doing what a drug company would do. It's to promote their brand and promote their products. And, you know, that's part of the capitalist process, right?
Right.
It's not ugly. It's ugly, but it's not perceived as ugly in the way that it's done. It's just perceived as help. And my whole objection to that is not on an anti-drug kind of basis at all. I'm not anti-drug. I'm not even anti-medication. If a person wants to take medication, you know? It's the idea of undercutting a person's agency and having them feel like they need to do a thing in order to make themselves right. When maybe it's not them at all, maybe it's their world that's not right. So watching this nurse take the students through this very specific process of going through a website and seeing her show them the drug company website and seeing her take them through the videos that had a logo of the drug company at the end of it and all that kind of stuff was kind of like, oh, you know, I was kind of scratching my head going, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
But it happened very specifically because public defunding of things means that we have more of a reliance on privatized entities to help us take things up. And so I'm maybe not describing it very well, but that was my real entry point into my PhD research. It was very sort of stark and shocking that all that happened to me. Or that happened.
Yeah, and hence the importance of a critical capitalist analysis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sherry, why is it important to study identity? Why is that so important?
Well, I think that young people are super susceptible to having their identity molded. And I hesitate to use that word, but it's the closest word I can think of right now to describe what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
in the sense that, you know, when you're a child, you're kind of an outcropping of whatever environment you're in, but at a certain point you are trying to individuate. And when you're trying to form your own identity, you're trying to pick, you know, how am I distinct from other people? Who am I? What do I like? What do I not like? Who do I want to be? What kind of stance do I want to take in this world? And I think if you have psychiatrized identities available, and particularly in education and sanctioned by institutions such as education, there is a propensity for young people to take these identities up and strongly hang on to those identities.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've described before, if you have this kind of endogenized, for lack of a better word, inward focusing identity, that you have this thing, you have depression, you have anxiety, there's a cutting off of possibility for identifying with, you know, how am I going to get involved in stopping climate change, or how am I going to work for economic justice, or how am I going to help the underdog in this world? You know, those kinds of bigger questions have less of a, not, I'm not going to say they're not there, because I'm not seeing that in the people that I'm talking to. And it's not true that that's not 100% the case, but I think it's just taking some energy away from those more outwardly focusing and world changing possibilities. And so that's sort of what I think about identity and young people in psychiatry.
Interesting take. Sherry, if you were to identify something, an angst, an issue, what would be your biggest bone to pick with psychiatry?
So when I wrote my comprehensive paper, which was about a year ago, I wrote about deviance. And this is all kind of tying back to what I've said before. But deviance in the past was considered like the rebel outsider. And I view psychiatry through its endogenizing effects as being like, it's not the world, it's you. It's you. So the idea of the deviant insider,
mm-hmm.
or the idea that you can be deviant through a psychiatric diagnosis or a psychiatric label, but still be enfolded into hegemonic processes or hegemony, because psychiatry is sanctioned, psychiatry is okay, psychiatric labels give you access to support, that's a problem. My biggest bone to pick with psychiatry is that it kind of enfolds deviance into itself and says, it's okay. It's you that's the problem, but it's still okay, which undercuts the rebellious aspect of the possibilities that are inherent in the idea of deviance.
Mm. Interesting. It's kind of like a violent or a toxic benevolent force.
Yeah, that's well said. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it's beautifully theorized this area. I really enjoy listening to you when you talk about your research and the development of identity and the sort of politicizing of identity beyond identity politics, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, thank you.
And Sherry, if you were, for our young listeners, for our youth listeners, and for those who care about them, if you were to offer a few words of wisdom or advice, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say, and like I said before, I'm not anti-help. I think people should have people to talk to when they're in distress. And God knows that COVID has pointed out to us that we are social beings and we need people to talk to when we're in distress. We need to have relations with other people. We need to understand that we're understood. And so just kind of putting that into the context of what I'm about to say next, after what I'm about to say now, which says I'm also not anti-biology, and there's obviously biological differences between us in terms of how much we respond to events with anxiety, because there are chemical processes involved in things like anxiety and also in sadness. It's not just context. Different people have more extreme reactions than other people. So it's not an anti-biology, it's not an anti-help stance. It's really an against being permanently identified with a state of being. So my advice would be to people that to understand yourself as having distress or being out of sorts or being highly agitated about something. And the about is the key word here, because it's always in context of different things like your life. And your life is not disentangled from capitalism at all. It always is entangled with capitalism. It's also entangled with your family. It's also entangled with your other relations. It's part of the existential aspect of being a human. So my advice would be to loosen your thinking around the medicalized aspects of how you're feeling now and to kind of pay attention to context. And to really, you know, think about the social construction and do some research in terms of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, because if you actually do some research into it and you look at the history of it, it's so different now than it was in 1952 that you cannot help but realize that these things are made up. They're not made up in the sense that sadness isn't made up, anxiety isn't made up, but the label anxiety disorder is a human-made thing that is created by people, by human beings that sit around tables and talk about research that's been done by human beings. And it's all socially contextualized as well.
I love that you used entanglements, one of my new favorite words these days. So
why is that?
Well, it's, there's a theory that emerged out of quantum physics called entanglement theory that's kind of made its way into the social sciences and modestly into the health sciences that I'm dabbling into these days. So entanglement is an everyday kind of banal word, really. But if you complicate it, in the sense that the world is entangled, you know, people and identities and abstractions and objects and things are entangled in a way that is impossible or nearly impossible to disentangle them and understand them separately, objectify them in a sense. It's really, I'm trying not to fetishize it, but I'm really liking entanglement theory these days. So
that sounds very interesting.
Yeah, we shall talk. We shall. So Sherry, listen, thank you for joining me today and for talking about your awesome work and for appearing on Crazy Making.
Thank you so much for having me.
Subscribe and listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. Reach out to us by email at crazymaking@yourq.ca. That's crazymaking@yourku.ca. And follow us on Instagram at crazymakingpodcast. This podcast is written and hosted by me, Simon Adam, and edited by Among Antariksh Sagar. Thanks for listening.